Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. In just a moment, we'll be recapping all the week's security news with our sometimes fill-in host, Alex Stamos. And then we'll be hearing from Thinkst Canary's very own Haroon Mir in this week's sponsor interview. I spoke to Haroon while he was in the USA just before he was about to deliver a talk to Usenix, to the Usenix event there, all about embracing hackiness. Haroon thinks hackiness is a huge advantage for red teams, but that doesn't mean blue teams can't use the same hacky approaches to defense. It's typically great Haroon Mir stuff, and it is coming up after the week's news segment with Alex Stamos, which starts now. So, Alex, our first news story of the week is this really weird lawsuit that Apple has launched against Corellium. Corellium, of course, being the company that makes a virtualization equipment that allows security researchers to virtualize Apple's iOS operating system. This suit, I mean, I've read through the complaint. Risky Business is even named in the complaint because we had the founder, a co-founder of Corellium, on the show some time back. But the whole lawsuit is just such a weird read. What's your take on this?
This is an interesting kind of Beauty and the Beast week for Apple. So as a lot of people know, Ivan Kristic, one of the key security engineers at Apple, gave a really well-received presentation at Black Hat in which they pulled back the curtain on a number of interesting OS X and iOS security protections, but they also announced that they are following what a number of other companies have done, and they are creating a special set of their products that are easier for people to hack. So they're creating effectively semi-debug versions of the iPhone that people who apply will be able to get to do iOS security development. But then just days later, they announced this lawsuit. Now, from the complaint, it seems pretty clear that Corellium is probably just straight up copying components of iOS into this virtual environment. But as you've talked about with their people, it is a core tool to be used for iOS security development. There's very few good ways for responsible researchers to do research on iOS at this moment.
Well, I should mention that the suit, it is a copyright suit. They're alleging that Corellium has, is copying iOS. But, to the best of my knowledge, what they sell is actually the virtualization equipment. They sell an ARM server that enables their customers to then download iOS themselves, which would make, and then Apple's got that license where you can only run their software on their hardware sort of thing, which would mean it's their customers who have the copyright problem, not Corellium necessarily. I mean, so it feels like maybe they're arguing more that this is like, they're going to have to argue that this is more that they're committing vicarious infringement, much like the makers of, peer-to-peer sharing software or whatever. I don't think it's as clear cut as you say.
So there's an interesting history here of companies suing people who build potential infringement devices, simulators and emulators. I was actually an expert witness for a lawsuit between IBM and a little company that built a emulator for IBM's mainframe systems. And it was the exact same kind of argument. In the end, IBM dropped the lawsuit and just bought the little company to make the whole problem go away. Whether Apple is legally correct or not, it's not a great look to at the same time saying that you are going to engage better with the security community to also eliminate one of the only ways that the security community can currently work on Apple's products.
The weird thing here is, right, like what it looks like, and we can only go on what's in the suit, right? What it looks like here is there's a lot of complaining in Apple's claim here. There's a lot of wah-wah-wah about how Corellium enables exploit development and those exploits are sold on the open market and all of this sort of stuff. So their lawsuit seems to be arguing that like exploit development is a terrible thing unless those exploits are being sold to Apple. And they even say in the suit, and oh, by the way, we pay people up to $1 million for these sorts of things. And it's just terrible that this company is enabling research that can be sold, on the so-called open market. The whole thing just reads like what they're arguing is that exploits should only ever be developed for Apple's benefit, right? Like it's weird.
It is. And it feels to me that all of that stuff is going to be legally not that relevant. What's going to be relevant is the exact implementation details of how Corellium works, whether or not they have ever pulled any code from any copyrighted Apple systems and included it. And if Apple can't show that, then I think they're going to have a harder time.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said too about that company that IBM sued, because, you know, there's I've seen it all over Twitter that the rumor is that Apple was looking at buying Corellium not so long ago.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, if you can't buy them, sue them. That Apple did not invent that kind of technique, though.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Apple is so concerned with copyright there. They didn't seem so concerned with copyright when they transcribed my interview with Joe Fitzpatrick last year and emailed it to every single press inbox in the world. Maybe I should send them a bill, knowing that they take copyright so seriously. Apple also in the news this week, you know, more iPhone news, really. And this is kind of funny, right? Like, they actually managed to reintroduce a kernel bug into their 12.4 update, which has made a jailbreak possible again for the first time in a long time, which is just, bit of egg on their face over this one.
Yes, this is actually really surprising to me. If you're going to have new kernel bugs, not shocking to reintroduce an old flaw that was reported back in the day. The timing on Corellium is interesting, too. I mean, this demonstrates why Apple needs to have an open relationship with the security community. They are not perfect. They make great devices. They have a very good security team. They make software, which comes from people and is fallible. To have this kind of really basic mistake at the same time they're trying to shut down security research, I don't think sends the message that I saw them trying to send from the stage of Black Hat.
Yeah. And we're still waiting on a patch for that one as of the time of recording. So that's, Now, look, big tech news this week, and it's the Bluetooth attack we've all been waiting for. You know, there's a lot of overhyped research on things like Bluetooth that you see here and there, which are sort of like weird edge cases and whatever. But this is straight up like an invalidation of Bluetooth as anything but an insecure transport mechanism, right? Like, this is research that shows that you can force a one-byte key between already paired Bluetooth devices. You don't even need to be there for the pairing or anything like that. This is like the worst-case scenario, and it's out there now.
Yes, some excellent research from three academic researchers. This was presented at the Usenix Security Symposium. It's a busy summer for security folks over the last couple of weeks, and it's kind of shocking that this exploit has not been discovered before. This is a straight-up design flaw in the handshake protocol for the generation of keys, like you said, not necessarily during the initial trust on first use, where you attach Bluetooth but can be used at any time, even later for a existing Bluetooth connection. That allows a middle person to force a downgrade to a one-byte key. And clearly, there is absolutely no algorithm that is secure with a one-byte key. You can't totally turn off encryption, you can force the connection into a place where there's absolutely no practical security. And then that means clearly that a number of different uses of Bluetooth, most of which do not provide their own transport security on top of it, are now vulnerable.
Yeah. I mean, Dan Guido is quoted in this piece by Ars Technica as saying, look, it's bad, but it's hard to exploit in practice because it requires local proximity, perfect timing, and a clear signal. I don't know that I agree with Dan on that necessarily, because if you can just put some Dropbox near the target, right, like that's going to give you your opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, what Dan is basically saying is that Bluetooth bugs overall are not that important, which is probably true in lots of cases, right? Like, there's not a huge number of critical uses of Bluetooth, but I am sure that they exist and that there are uses of Bluetooth that should not exist, perhaps for medical devices, perhaps for a number of IoT situations. And so in all of those cases, it has always been true that you needed to provide your own security. This once again reinforces that these kinds of standard transports cannot be relied upon for providing any kind of integrity or confidentiality. And if you're going to use something like Bluetooth, you're going to have to bootstrap your own security on top of it, assume it is pre-owned.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the go with patching here? Like, I understand that some devices just won't be able to be patched against this, others will. Is that kind of the gist here?
That is. It looks like there are patches now available for all the major operating systems, Windows, macOS, iOS, watchOS, for Android, for a number of other mobile devices. If you do the patch, it seems that at a minimum, it will reduce the chance of a full middle person attack. But there are still probably scenarios that as long as there is one unpatched device, that there will still be some kind of vulnerability.
Yay! Now, yeah. Confirmation of what we thought relating to the Capital One breach, the attacker, Paige Thompson, apparently breached 30 other companies, right? Like, this isn't the worst news, right? Because what we're talking about here is someone who just did it for shiggles, right? So it's not like Paige Thompson was operating some criminal enterprise, but yeah, very busy hacker lady.
Yeah, this is interesting. So there's a couple interesting things here. First is the list of companies and organizations this might include: UniCredit, Vodafone, Ford, Michigan State, Ohio Department of Transportation. So a pretty random sampling of organizations that seem to be using AWS makes me feel like this is Thompson getting lucky and scanning for vulnerabilities such as the Capital One without targeting individuals. The second is that the government has not finished notifying all these organizations, which sounds kind of shocking to me. We're talking about having a couple of weeks of this forensic information, so I'm really not sure what's holding things up. But like you said, there doesn't seem to be any actual impact on end users at this point, so maybe this is a good warning for both AWS and for its users that there needs to be some significant work put in to looking for some basic flaws like SSRF and OpenS3 buckets and the like.
Nonetheless, I do not expect the court to sentence Paige Thompson to, you know, to receive $5 and a sun hat and a pat on the back, right? Like, probably going to have a bad time.
I think Thompson's in real trouble. This is, I think, actually quite a sad, if you read her social media, this sounds like a kind of a call for help, but if you're going to cry out for help from somebody, the federal government
probably isn't the right people.
Is not the people that you want to get that from. Yeah,
yeah, makes sense. And we got this really. I thought it was a little bit strange, actually. This letter from AWS to Senator Ron Wyden talking about this whole situation, saying SSRF isn't really much of a problem. We don't really know of any substantial breaches. They haven't been alerted to us. What did you make of this letter now that, you know, AWS has been asked to respond and this is their response?
To Amazon's credit, first, the letter does come from Steve Schmidt, who's the CISO of AWS, and it does have some details about SSRF and the kind of work they do. So generally, these responses to senators are written by the local lobbying teams and is only PAP on top of comms BS. But in this case, there is a little bit of information. I do think it is interesting to say that there are no other noteworthy SSRF compromises AWS customers. That is a pretty broad claim.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's an issue here of the AWS metadata service being abused. It is not Amazon's fault, but just because it is not their fault does not mean it is not their responsibility. And I think what this entire class of issues is demonstrating, and especially the ones that Thompson has unveiled, is that the move to the cloud has been positive in a lot of ways, but giving all of the power of a massive infrastructure as a service providers like AWS to corporate IT teams needs to be done very, very carefully. And there needs to be significant guardrails put up, especially for organizations that are new to the cloud. And I think my guess is that this is going to cause a number of changes in the way that AWS provisions out their default services, how they onboard their customers, and the kinds of scanning they're doing themselves. If Thompson has the ability to find all of these vulnerable systems, AWS themselves has that capability. And I expect that they are going to step up to see it more of their responsibility, because in the end, they're the ones who are getting letters from senators. They're the ones whose brand is being smeared in a number of news stories. So whether or not it is technically their fault, they are going to have a responsibility, and it is the smart thing for them to do the best they can to prevent these issues in the future.
Yeah, look, I guess an issue that's sort of come to the fore here is that, you know, there are so many subtle ways for your cloud deployments to go wrong. So many permissions, so many weird little settings, right? I mean, we had Travis McPeak on the show early last year. He works for Netflix, and or did at the time, I don't know if he still does, but he'd help put together a tool called RepoKid. And the whole point of that tool was to actually rein in Amazon permissions. And, you know, I've been in discussions with some people who think that maybe Amazon is going to make some changes to the metadata service API, and there'll be like a version 2 and version 1 will still be available. And then, you know, then you're sort of drifting into that legacy territory, right, where people don't necessarily know that you need to disable the API v1 access and still get into trouble that way, right? Like, I think we're starting to see maybe the dawn of the Amazon legacy issues, right? I mean,
Yes.
What do you think of that?
I think you're totally right. I think Amazon is going to, unless they are very aggressive about forcing an upgrade schedule, they are going to fall into the trap that Microsoft has been in for 20 years.
Backwards compatibility.
When you're an enterprise product, you will always have customers who lag behind. The question is the risk to users and the risk to other customers worth supporting those old technologies? My hope is that Amazon sets a bit of a new standard here in forcing these folks to upgrade. And I'm glad you mentioned Netflix. They have done more than anybody to understand and to help publicly mitigate these risks, even though it has no direct impact on Netflix's bottom line. So it's great to see them talking about this stuff and releasing these tools publicly.
Yeah. Now we're getting into, this is your jam, the next series of stories here.
Yes, exactly.
Hong Kong. Things are pretty volatile in Hong Kong, and we've been seeing just an amazing number of, an amazing disinformation and misinformation campaign being run from the Chinese government. I mean, things are very heated here in Australia. We have a large Chinese population. We have a lot of Chinese students in the country. We've even seen violent clashes between Chinese nationalists and people supporting the protests in Hong Kong. We've seen that on university campuses here in Australia. It's all pretty intense right now, and Twitter and Facebook have just scrubbed a whole bunch of, I think what you, the term you would use, Alex, is coordinated inauthentic behavior. crazy times at the moment, right?
Yeah, and really fascinating time. So it has been well known for a while that the People's Republic of China has a significant information warfare capability that they have utilized against Chinese language sources in the past. The seminal work on this is a piece by Jennifer Pan, who's now a colleague of mine at Stanford, and Gary Keen of Harvard, in which they studied what is called the 50 Cent Army, which is effectively the amateur corps of propagandists who do work on behalf of the Chinese government. They did a lot of looking into how these people were coordinated, how instructions came from Beijing, and how they operated. That was specifically about Chinese language work. Since this latest round of Hong Kong protests, we have seen the Chinese move into Western social media. Like you said, Facebook and Twitter have announced things. They are on other social media platforms who have not announced anything. So we can talk about that in a second. But that movement into doing this in English in the West seems to be something that they are much less prepared to do. So Twitter and Facebook had synchronized announcements. Twitter took down a significantly larger number of accounts. There's coordination on the back end between Twitter and Facebook on this. It looks like the initial tip went from Twitter to Facebook, but both of them took these things down. And if you look at the content that has been taken down, it looks like there's actually three kinds of accounts that are being used here. So there's been, I think, too many journalists have used the term using the Russian playbook. I'm actually getting really frustrated by that because this is very clearly different than how the Russians operated in 2016. The different networks you're looking on Twitter is there's the actual 50 Cent Army people. So it looks like from some of the information that the Chinese dropped the Great Firewall to allow access to Facebook and Twitter by a number of their citizens. This is a pretty good tell that they are being sponsored by the government. Just all of a sudden, Chinese IP addresses working on Twitter is a pretty big sign. And so that's probably the most amateur operation. And then there's a set of accounts that have very complicated histories. A number of the accounts look like they've been stolen in the past. Doni from CNN traced down one of these accounts to its original owner who had the account taken over. So it looks like the Chinese are either doing credential stuffing attacks or more likely are buying stolen Twitter accounts on the black market. And then we've seen a bunch of amplification of Chinese propaganda by spam networks that are also doing other kinds of amplification. And so if you look at it altogether, unlike the Russian operation, which took years and years to build up this capability and to backstop all these identities, the Chinese have very quickly tried to bootstrap a capability in the West. And the result is actually quite amateur and I don't think very effective.
Yeah, I mean, they're pushing the line that the Hong Kong protesters are terrorists, which is a bit of a stretch when you got, like, what, 1.7 million of them marching, right? Like, I doubt they're all terrorists, you know?
Right, and there's multiple propaganda operations going on. So, you know, what we're really only talking about is the obvious, very overt operation that is happening on Facebook and Twitter. Clearly, there is something going on WeChat. I expect that WeChat is one of the most powerful both information gathering and propaganda tools for the Ministry of State Security and other PRC organs.
Sorry, I just got to cut in there because something really funny happened here. There was a pro-Hong Kong protester here in Australia who had managed to get into the WeChat groups for a bunch of the pro-mainland Chinese groups who were organizing protests and stuff at at Australian campuses and whatever. And they just used enough keywords that the WeChat censors flagged them as possible, like, Hong Kong protesters and booted them, right? So it's not all perfectly coordinated.
No, hundreds of thousands of people are involved with the Chinese propaganda arms. So there's absolutely no way they're not going to step on each other's toes. But basically my point being, we shouldn't judge the effectiveness of the campaign that is aimed both at people in Hong Kong and on the citizens of the PRC by the ham-fisted attempts to manipulate people in the West. It is quite likely that work is being much more effective. Although, like you said, 1.7 million people showing up, if one of the goals of the PRC was to separate the student protesters from the normal citizens of Hong Kong, they have clearly failed to this point. I find this actually quite scary. So when I talk to the China experts at Stanford and elsewhere, it's becoming pretty clear that the PRC government and that the Chinese Communist Party is being backed into a corner. And so it's very possible that we're going to see, since they can't win the propaganda war, that they will suppress these protests in a violent manner like Tiananmen Square. And that could end up obviously being a pretty horrible thing for a number of people. So my hope is that the eyes of the world prevent that from happening, but it is unclear whether or not the CCP will be able to put up with this kind of unrest any longer.
Well, I mean, you know, the question is there nationalism? You know, are they nationalists to the extent that they're prepared to kill the golden goose, right? Like, that's the question right now. But the, you know, from what I can tell, the sentiment among mainland Chinese is not particularly friendly towards those in Hong Kong at the moment.
No, certainly the CCP is not going to have a lot of pushback from the mainland for suppression of the folks in Hong Kong. I expect they don't have to do much to get these 50 Cent Army folks to go talk crap about people in Hong Kong. Like, these are actually really held sentiments. The other issue here is that compared to over 20 years ago when Hong Kong was turned back over to the PRC, it has become a much less critical part of the Chinese economy, right? We've seen a couple of decades of very strong economic growth in China. There are a number of finance and industrial hubs throughout the mainland. And so while the Chinese would certainly not want to destroy the economic growth and the gateway to Western finance that Hong Kong represents, they are also much less dependent on Hong Kong than they were a couple decades ago. So yeah. I'm not sure we should rely upon the economics here to save the protesters and to protect them. And the truth is that demands they are making are the kinds of things that the CCP could never offer other Chinese citizens, right? Free and fair elections is the death knell for the Communist Party. And so for them to set a precedent here, I think would be very dangerous for them. I'm not sure how they get out of this without violence.
Oh, well, that's depressing. But I guess, look, summing this up, we're going to say that the stuff that we're seeing in the West is a very small tip of a much larger iceberg that is mostly concentrated on mainland China itself when it comes to their disinformation efforts.
That's right. We should not overestimate the importance of Western viewers here. This is mostly about the domestic Chinese audience and their reaction to Hong Kong.
Yeah. Also worth noting that Twitter has given 30 days notice that they will ban state media organizations from being able to buy promoted tweets. So that is interesting. But look, moving on, and there's a story in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm not quite sure what to make of this one, right? Like, we've seen denials flying around on it. Not that I believe the denials either. But even the core of the story here seems like, it feels like it's a little bit of a stretch, right? So the headline is Huawei technicians helped African governments spy on political opponents. Now, when you outsource the maintenance of parts of your telco infrastructure to a third party, I would imagine that that is, you know, that third party is going to be involved when you actually want to surveil someone, right? So I think perhaps the story here is more about the fact that African governments are surveilling their political opponents rather than Huawei doing something unexpected here, right?
Yeah, you could rewrite this story for any company operating in the United States and
AT&T contractors help fulfill FBI warrants, right?
Right, yeah. Company, you know, follows CALEA rules. Like, the core issue here is not that Huawei followed the local request. The core issue is that a number of countries, the surveillance tools that have been built for legitimate law enforcement purposes are often turned against political opponents. I think this demonstrates where there's a difference between equipment that is running in a country that is under traditional ICT regulations in the same way that it happens in every developed democracy. If this was Google or Facebook or Twitter helping the Ugandan government, I would see that as a totally different thing. Like, there's a subtle difference between infrastructure that is partially paid for and regulated that is running within a country within their domestic sphere.
Well, and the allegation here isn't even that the Huawei equipment was used. The allegation here is that the Huawei technicians somehow assisted in the deployment of NSO-style malware to the devices of these politicians, right?
Yeah, it's, you know,
I mean, it just feels like a way to squeeze Huawei into a headline, right? And look, regular listeners would know it's not like I get all weepy for Huawei's troubles, but it just feels like this one is a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, I think you can hold two ideas in your mind, which is the existence and success of Huawei is a long-term strategic problem for the West, and this is not a situation that they should have direct responsibility for.
Yeah, I agree. Cyber Command dropping some more malware samples to VirusTotal. I always enjoy this. I always enjoy reporting on these. This time it is Lazarus Group malware, originating out of North Korea. Nice to see this program continuing.
I continue to love the fact that Cyber Command is using VirusTotal as their mechanism to get this information out to all of the different anti-malware tools around the world. This is interesting because the tools they dropped on VirusTotal and therefore hopefully burned from use, it doesn't look like either one of these tools were actually exploits. One of them is a tunneling tool. The other is a fake TLS proxy. So these are examples of the kinds of tools that professional teams build and then reuse over and over again in multiple campaigns. The fact that Cyber Command is going and burning this is really probably a pain in the butt for the Lazarus.
Yeah, because they're burning their boring tools, right? Like, not their exciting stuff. And that's the stuff. It's just your workaday stuff. And rewriting it, it's going to be a pain in the ass.
It's going to be a pain. And unlike, you know, O'Days and such, there's no good way to patch against these issues. And so burning this malware and these tools via VirusTotal is actually a great way to do it. I also love the way they talk about this, that releasing malware is part of U.S. Cyber Command's persistent engagement methodology, which is basically saying we're going to keep at this, right? Like, they are going to keep infiltrating systems controlled by U.S. adversaries and then doing everything they can just to make their lives difficult. And I think that's great. As a taxpayer, this is what I like to see Cyber Command doing, going out there, being active, just increasing the bar and making Lazarus Group put engineering resources on rebuilding basic things.
Yeah, it's going to slow them down, man.
Yeah, we had of going and building new stuff.
We had Kate Charlotte in an interview last week on the show. Look that one up if you haven't heard it. She talks about this concept of constant contact, constant engagement. Pretty interesting stuff, and this is a nice example of that. Moving to Texas, and 23 local government agencies in Texas have been ransomwared in what looks to be a coordinated attack. We are just seeing there's a steady drumbeat of these large-scale incidents really affecting, you know, these types of agencies at the moment. And I just have a feeling this is going to get so much worse before it gets better.
I think it is. I have lots of empathy for people who work at the state and local municipal level in the United States and around the world. There are tons of incredibly important systems that have lots of critical uses and sometimes access to really important personal data that are being maintained by folks who are not getting budget, they're not getting support. And this is a great example of how that can go wrong. And in this case, this was a coordinated attack. So 23 different organizations in Texas were hit at the same time. And so this seems like a real escalation from what we saw in Baltimore.
And this is the whole reason you would do this, right? Is because you're going to increase the likelihood of actually receiving a payment when you hit one locality, you stretch the resources of that region, right? Like, right. I mean, are there even enough incident responders in the private sector to go and deal with 23 cases at once?
Well, and what's that going to cost?
Yeah.
Yeah. Even if you could hire out Mandiant and CrowdStrike for the month, it's almost certainly cheaper to pay the ransom. And to talk about kind of political events, this should also be a warning for election security, because it is the exact same people who are running these systems who are the ones who are responsible for the systems that Americans are going to vote on starting next spring. Like, you're talking about the exact same kinds of problems. In that case, we're not going to see ransomware. We're going to see much more subtle attacks.
You don't think we'll see wiper attacks and stuff?
We might. I mean, there's a variety of things you can do. If you want to throw the American election into chaos, ransomware, wipers, subtly changing data for which you know that there's no backups, that kind of stuff can really cause a lot of damage and create legal cases that will last for months and months in the United States.
Yeah, something to look forward to. I mean, I look at November next year, I see that approaching, and I just think, chances are it'll go okay, but there is a non-trivial risk there that something bad could happen, don't you think?
If the 2020 election goes okay, it's because a number of U.S. adversaries have decided not to mess it up, not because we did a great job as a society.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I got some supply chain news here. Webmin, which apparently is a popular web-based utility for managing Unix servers, so it's like pointy clicky management for Nix boxes. It's been backdoored, and there's like apparently a million installs of this. That's less than ideal.
Yeah, less than ideal. Highly privileged web app. Shodan shows 215,000 Webmins facing the internet. Now, the only upside is it looks like the backdoor is in a component of Webmin that is not turned on by default. And there's actually some commit history that shows that the attacker that inserted the backdoor realized that and then tried to make a change to turn on that feature by default.
And that's when they got detected? Or?
Yeah, I think so. And so that demonstrates that it's unlikely that there's a lot of human impact. Once again, this might have been a close call that demonstrates the humongous risk from some of these really critical and not professionally secured open source tools.
Yeah. Well, and look, staying with the theme, apparently 11 Ruby libraries, including some quite popular ones, have been backdoored as well.
Yeah. The, you know, Ruby, Node, you know, all of these platforms that are incredibly popular with developers because of their use of centralized package managers, there is going to be some kind of massive hack, probably a theft of Bitcoin based upon one of these pretty soon, if there hasn't already and we haven't heard about it yet.
Yeah.
It's just, there's two, your web of trust, if you're using Ruby gems or NPM, is so incredibly large. There's no way that you can trust it. And unfortunately, a huge number of very important enterprises just allow their developers to use these package managers as part of their standard build processes.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're not using package managers, I remember in the early days of Veracode, they did analysis of enterprise software and just found that, like, you know, these vulnerable libraries just showed up basically at all of the Fortune 500.
Yes.
You know?
No, that's totally right. And it's very hard to fix that once you do it, right? Like, once you have one of these packages in there and is a trusted part of the source code, it is very hard to root those out without a bunch of different static and semantic analysis tools.
I should point out, too, the Webmin thing, one thing that makes that interesting is the attacker compromised it via the build infrastructure, so it wouldn't show up in, like, source audits and stuff. So that was, you know, nice work, whoever you are. Too bad you got caught. Story here from ZDNet saying that, pointing out that you can really degrade the quality of Tor connections, like all of them, quite severely for about 17,000 US a month in resources, which I think is quite interesting. I think one thing that papers like this tend to ignore is that once you start doing that, right, once you start running an attack of that sort of scale that requires 17,000 a month in resources, chances are the people who are providing you connectivity to perform that attack are going to give you the boot. But, you know, this is an interesting story, right, particularly in the context of 8chan being kicked off the open web and people are like, well, you know, there's an onion site. It's like they don't scale and they're not reliable.
That's right. I mean, there's this whole class of research that really boils down to Tor is not as decentralized as you think,
yeah.
Right? And this is some really smart research. So these folks looked at the fact that the top line number of the amount of bandwidth Tor has is actually pretty impressive, right? 500 or so gigabits per second is the overall transit available to Tor. And so that's obviously not a realistic DDoS, but then they dove into the different ways that Tor is centralized, such as relays, Tor bridges, looked at a couple of different tools, and they found that there are places, there are choke points that would require a lot less work to cause degrade. The interesting thing here is it has been known for a long time that governments could really make things hard for Tor, and yet they have not decided to do so. And I continue to find that to be interesting, of whether or not there just isn't a agency with the wherewithal and the power to make that decision, or if there are reasons why a number of groups have just looked into it and decided that wasn't worth it. And I am not sure why we don't see more direct attacks against Tor, more examples of exit nodes being compromised, and all the other kinds of things that you could realistically see nation-state level adversaries do.
Yeah. I mean, it'll happen one day, right? So,
It's happening now. I mean, yeah. The paranoid argument would be that a significant portion of the upstream from exit nodes is probably being sniffed one way or another. And if people are imperfect in their OPSEC, which everybody is eventually, then a lot of illegal activity and intelligence activity and such are eventually going to be traced back to individuals. And so Tor might be a good way for global law enforcement to centralize bad activity. And if that is true, then that would lead for the major governments of the world to decide to leave it alone.
Yeah. I mean, an interesting side note there is, you know, WikiLeaks' original document cache came from sniffing exit nodes. I mean, that's been my theory. I think someone close to WikiLeaks kind of semi-confirmed that like years ago. But if you ever wondered how they managed to get 300,000 documents, like when no one had heard of them, that seems like a pretty likely way that they did it, particularly when people were using, you know, various intelligence agencies were doing their exfil over Tor just for stealth, right? So that's right. Interesting side note there. Krebs actually has this interesting story about an app called Bluetana, and this looks for Bluetooth-based payment card skimmers that are on like petrol pumps, gas pumps at service stations. Great bit of tooling here. Cops have been using it and actually have been finding skimmers with it.
Yeah, I love to see the story. This looks like a great cooperation between academic CS folks at UC San Diego and the University of Illinois to build a tool that is practical to find skimmers that are physically embedded within gas pumps. I didn't realize that was such a large issue that you could build one of these tools and just walk around and find a bunch of them, but apparently you can. I also think it was really interesting to see the a good consolidation in this Krebs story in a, you know, beautifully formatted computer modern computer science table of the different kinds of prices for different things on the black market. And so that's a great resource of pulling together research from a number of different places. You know, for example, that a no pin debit card is worth $20-$30, but with a pin it's worth over $110. That's pretty amazing. I'm actually surprised that the price is that high, that you can monetize a debit card that well, considering all of the modern tools in place to detect and stop that kind of fraud.
Yeah. I mean, I look at the trouble that I have just occasionally with my banks, you know, flagging stuff as potential fraud when it's not. And you just think, God, you know, they must be really be good at finding the gaps in those fraud systems to be able to monetize that stuff. Just quickly, I want to mention CyberScoop has a story here talking about Fin7 and Cobalt Group, you know, sort of updating their malware and tactics. The only reason I find this one worthy of inclusion is because, you know, Fin7, there were some indictments, but the group, you know, people in possession of those tools and that knowledge, they're continuing unabated. So that's just something for our friends in finance to keep an eye on. Google wants to reduce the lifespan of TLS, you know, HTTPS certificates to 1 year from 2. I believe the thinking behind this is SSL revocation sucks, so reducing the time would be a good thing to do. What do you think about this?
So another potential victory for Ryan Slavey. So for those who don't know, Ryan is Google's representative at the CA Browser Forum. That is the organization between the major browser manufacturers and the certificate authorities that come up with these decisions. Ryan's incredible power is he doesn't really care what people think of him in the CA browser forum. And as a result, he continues to push forward these ideas that initially sound insane and then become the standard. I think this is a very smart move. And the best support for this being a reasonable idea is the success of Let's Encrypt. As folks know, Let's Encrypt only gives you very short-lived certs.
3 months.
Yeah, 3 months. Let's Encrypt requires people to set up automated certificate rotation tools. And the fact that Let's Encrypt has been so successful and that so many people have been able to make it work in their production systems demonstrates that a year is a totally reasonable amount of time.
Yeah. Facebook is launching a data abuse bounty for Instagram apps. This looks interesting, right? So the idea is you get paid a bounty when you find an Instagram app doing dodgy stuff with user data. Seems a good way to make use of that, you know, that whole crowdsourcing concept.
This is an expansion of a data abuse bounty that was launched for the other part of Facebook, the big Facebook.com app, when I was still there in 2018. It is a recognition of the fact that the issues plaguing Facebook are as much about the misuse of data as actual traditional information security flaws. So in this case, incentivizing people to go out and find the misuse of APIs, to find partners of companies that are misusing data, I think is a totally valid way to spend this money. The challenge here, I think, is going to be the definitional one, right? Which is, it is easy to say whether or not a web vulnerability is actually a vuln. There's lots of fights with bug bounty participants, but in the end, we've kind of figured out the ways around that. It is going to be much harder to argue whether or not some use of data was authorized or appropriate. And so there is certainly a risk for Facebook here. And I know a number of other companies are going to be watching to see whether or not that backfires.
Oh, yeah. Also, Facebook has awarded a $100,000 prize for a new code isolation technique. Makes use of some Intel features. I don't think we really got time to talk about it, but people should have a look at the ZDNet story and maybe click through to the paper. And finally, Yubico. Disclaimer, they are a risky business sponsor, small sponsor, but they are a sponsor and I should disclose that. They have released a YubiKey, finally, that has a Lightning connection, so you can now use your YubiKey with your iPhone. I think that's, I'm going to get one, right? It's awesome.
Yeah, I've got one. I got a prototype from a Yubico friend of mine, handed to me at Black Hat. I've been playing with it. It is really, really cool. The significant issue continues to be the fact that Apple is not including support for FIDO or WebAuthn in iOS. Even though they are not supported themselves, this can be used by Brave's iOS browser to do WebAuthn. And so there are ways you can use it on Apple devices, but we're still waiting for Apple to support it to make it available to more apps.
Well, I think one of the big uses here is going to be for your Google apps, right? Because in Google's like advanced protection program, the way that you would authenticate a mobile device is through one of those Bluetooth FATAN fobs, right? And they've got problems. So this kind of solves that problem for those users. I'd imagine that Google will be baking in support into its iOS apps.
They haven't yet, but I totally expect they can. The fact that Brave was able to do it with a very small development team indicates that Google should be able to do it without a problem.
Yeah. Well, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for coming along to be our alternate host for the week. It's been a lot of fun to chat to you, and I believe you're going to be back in a couple of weeks.
That's the plan. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
That was Alex Stamos there with a look at the week's security news headlines. Big thanks to Alex for that. It's great having him as an alternate host in the show. I'm really enjoying that. I'm getting great feedback from the listeners as well. And he'll actually be back in a couple of weeks to do it all again when Adam is off on his annual company retreat. But yeah, Metal is back in the news chair next week, so you'll all get your Metal fix then. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with my good friend, Haroon Mir. Haroon is, of course, the founder of Thinxt Canary. It's great defensive tech. Some people call it deception technology. Whatever you call it, it's pretty awesome and sneaky. If you don't know about Canary, you can check them out at canary.tools. They make things like hardware honeypots and some great cloud services that you can use to manage things like Canary tokens. But Haroon is here to give us a basic rundown on the talk he was invited to deliver to the Usenix conference. It's all about embracing hackiness. Haroon says, thinking like an attacker isn't everything. Embracing hackiness, he says, is really where it's at for blue teams. Here's Haroon.
For a long time, people have looked at offense in security and tritely said, like, you need to learn from offense. You need to think like an attacker. And of course, we've been saying that for super long, right? Like that was the concept with Satan way back, that you just need to think like an attacker. And just magically saying think like an attacker doesn't work. Surprise, surprise. Like Adam Shostak has a quote where he says, it's like telling someone to just think like a chef and seeing how their baking turns out. The interesting thing is that attackers have been getting stuff right. If you look at the success rates of red teams and blue teams, it's clear that red teams have been doing really well for themselves. And so people have started putting too much faith on this. You need to think like an attacker. When it's not just a thought process, like red has some advantages going for it that blue doesn't. And I discussed some of them before, but one of the big ones that I think make a difference is that red teams embrace hackiness more than blue teams do. And this runs through a few things. So from the top of it, I think one of the big advantages that red teams have is that they have super tight feedback loops. Like it's possible to be a defender for a really long time and not know that you suck, or not know that you're spending time on the wrong things. But if you an attacker and you're sucking at it, you know pretty quickly that you're not breaking into things. And this tight feedback loop is missing for lots of people who are in defense. Then I think there's a few other things that red teams kind of got right accidentally. One of them is that red teams almost by default expect things to be broken. So for years, we've been giving people training on how to break into networks. And almost by default, you teach people that their tools won't work like they expect. You're getting back a shell, but it's not echoing your commands properly. That's fine. You hack around it. You're stuck on a strange shell that doesn't have everything that you need. You hack around it. And so red teams have learned to accept brokenness almost as part of the game and hack around it. While on blue teams, you see a lot of this doesn't work, we're going to throw it out, we need a new tool. And what's interesting is that when the ground underneath is so fluid, the team that embraces hackiness seems to be winning. So I think that sort of hackiness is big. And it kind of ties in to my next point, which is you almost never see good offensive teams that don't code or at least hack their tools somewhat. And this goes back to something we've discussed on the podcast a long time ago, which is the fact that defensive teams need to be building more things, building more tool chains, and effectively doing more coding and development themselves.
I'm going to jump in there because like one thing that I've noticed, which I think is quite promising, is one of the major appeals for people to turn to the dark side of the red team, right? Like one of the thrills of being a pen tester is like popping shells and whatever. But I found that like, you know, it's the sneakiness that people really enjoy about it, right? They like having license to be sneaky. But I feel like I've met people on blue teams now who are just as sneaky right. as offensive people, and they are getting similar thrills out of being sneaky on the defensive right. side, right? Precisely by doing the sort of things that you're suggesting, yeah. by hacking together some weird, you know, detection methodology or something that actually really works and ruins the attacker's day, right? And that's how they're getting their thrills. So I feel like we're kind of at the Absolutely. Point where you're getting like, you know, almost adrenaline parity, red team versus blue team. And that's that's really going to change the dynamic, don't you think?
Yeah, I think adrenaline parity is an interesting way to put it. And I'm totally with you. Like I think there's lots and lots of really cool hacks to be pulled on blue team. And in some ways, it's more interesting because you've got more challenges. So for sure, I think you're starting to see that come up to the front more and more. And I think it's exciting times.
Look, obviously, you know, some of this thinking has gone into the Thinks Canary, right? Because that is, you know, it's a sneaky bit of tech. It relies on tricking people into interacting with it and whatever. And you get like, you know, you get your cheap thrills when it goes off, right? But what are some other right. ways that someone, you know, and obviously like canary tokens and stuff, that's similar sneaky blue team thinking. Can you think of some other examples for the listeners though?
Yeah, so I think one of the big mistakes that people make, like after any big breach, you'll see people say things like, well, they just didn't do the basics. And you'll see a whole bunch of thought leaders talk about, like, it's time to get back to basics. And of course, in many ways, what they're making is a bit of a survivorship bias error, right? Because there's like a zillion basics that need doing. And every time there's a breach where one of those basics aren't done, people go, oh, they missed this basic. How simple of them. And so part of the hack and part of the reason why good blue team members are hard to find is focusing on those few items which give you high fidelity indications that badness is happening on your network. So there's almost a hack that says from this galaxy of defenses that we can put down, which are the handful for our enterprise that absolutely let us know when badness is happening? And then figuring out how those can be dropped, how those can be implemented and reliably picked up. And it kind of goes back to something else that we talk about, which is way, way long ago, I gave a talk at CCDC. And this was pre-Snowden and pre all of that. And I remember one of the key points that I said back then was, people should stop looking at big DDoS events as major hacker events. And one of the things that I was trying to say back then is you can tell really elite hackers by their tool chains. And the logic then was that as attackers get more and more experience, the thing that you notice is they start developing more complex tooling because all of their tooling starts building on each other. And what you notice from really good blue teams is the same sort of thing happens because they'll build a piece of technology that says, okay, here's a dashboard that we can send alerts off into. And then the next thing they build, they go, well, this is simple. All we've got to do is emit to our dashboard. Or like a long time ago, you and I spoke about the guys at Square who used trust anchors. And it's the same logic that once you build out this piece for your environment, you'll just find more and more use for it and more defenses for it that start to work together for you, and it becomes a force multiplier.
Now, look, one other thing I want to touch on while I've got you is obviously you are just on the tail end of a US trip. You were just at Black Hat where you ran a booth. You know, some time ago, I think it was like, even a couple of years ago now, you wrote about the experience of being a startup vendor and being at RSA. And surprisingly, you know, as one of the people who threw like crap at RSA over the years, just like me, you actually found it a worthwhile experience. What was your experience like as a booth holder at Black Hat, and how did it compare to RSA?
Yeah, it's super interesting. So the first thing, going to Black Hat is just comparing it to years and years of going to Black Hat as a speaker, and. Like the main difference is going to Black Hat.
That was the most epic humble brag we've ever had in Risky Biz. Yeah, it's real weird going as a vendor. You know, normally I'm there as a speaker.
That was like that.
That was epic. I know you didn't, but you know, it doesn't matter.
So now I blush on Risky Biz. So the interesting difference is you miss a lot more meetings as a vendor. Like vendor Black Hat is just a series of being late for meetings with people. But in truth, it was interesting. So again, running the booth turned out to be good for us. Like, we end up meeting lots of our customers. We end up meeting lots of Risky Business listeners, which is cool. Quite a few of them took selfies or took pictures, which
your selfies were everywhere on Twitter through Black Hat. it was amazing.
It's apparently a new thing. Like you meet people and they go, can we take a selfie? Which is still a little bit weird. The booth was interesting. It worked out well. What's interesting to note is that the booth is more expensive than RSA, more than double the price. The booths were slick, like a whole bunch of people spent a whole bunch of money on their booths. Again, for us, easily worth it. I think we're in a bit of a different category there because, like, we do a fair amount of business with people who we've never met. So they get a chance to drop by and we get to talk about stuff and they tell us how it works. But in general, booting still works for us. I spoke to Paul Lanzi from Remediant, and he was pretty happy with their boot also. So I think if you've got a product that's selling, a boot still works out. But for sure, the cost is so.
I think the takeaway here is make sure you've got something people want. Funny,
yeah,
huh?
At, with the RSA booth at that point, like if you're going there because you want to be discovered, I think people are too busy. If you've got something that people have heard about and people are saying nice things about, it kind of gives people a chance to pop in and see a demo and confirm what they were hearing. But yeah, Black Hat's definitely more expensive for a smaller number of people. Another friend of the show, Kelly Shortridge, wrote a whole post on analysis of the vendor hall. And one of the interesting takeaways that she had was that about 30% of the vendor hall is new every year.
Yeah.
So it seems like they've got a fair churn rate. I think companies either flaming out in the year or figuring out that it wasn't that worth it, possibly. 30% is a pretty high churn rate.
It is, man. But that's this industry. You look at the number of thousands of security vendors who didn't exist a few years ago, right? Like, God, there's yeah. a shakeout coming eventually, right? Like, considering my livelihood kind of depends on this crazy number of security companies, right? I kind of pay attention, and there's got to be some consolidation coming at some point. But Haroon, thank you, as always, for your sage words, my friend. It's always a pleasure to chat to you, and we'll catch up again soon.
Super cool. Thanks, Patrick.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinks to Canary there. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow with a soapbox edition of the show featuring Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.